Today, austerity by design, who's taking the biss? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Well, that is Post, covering finance and property news. And today I want to pick up a conversation we had a couple of weeks ago with Lisa Barwick from the Citizens Party, where we spoke about some of the issues relating to the Australian Green being killed. And one of the critical things that came out in that conversation actually was the concept of austerity. So today, Lisa, we're going to talk about the foundations of austerity. And I guess the way into this is to understand that there are a series of technocrats around the place in these large institutional organizations. I suppose we could talk about the World Economic Forum, we could talk about the Bank for International Settlements and the United Nations, all of which have a particular set of doctrines, a particular set of the way the world works, but a top-down, non-democratic way that the world works. And it doesn't necessarily impact ordinary people that well, does it?
Absolutely not. yes, last time we talked, we spoke a little bit about some of the history and how a select group of bankers, particularly out of the City of London, but the net has grown wider over time, of course, who wanted to deliberately take policymaking out of the hands of elected officials. And as you say, put it into the hands of technocrats, so-called experts. You know, you couldn't trust important economic decisions to anyone who wasn't a trained economist or an expert. And that has been the drive from the period of history we talked about when we last spoke after World War One, and we talked about the fact that a lot of countries had to create national credit. Many of them hadn't done that before, but some countries like Australia were doing it very well, and it took off, and it had to be stopped because it meant that nations would develop and cooperate, and a small handful, a small club of elite bankers, their future would not be assured. They wouldn't be able to continue the lifestyle to which they were accustomed if that happened, because the masses would all benefit. You would have the opposite of what we've got today, which is inequality. You would actually have a greater sense of equality, that people could be brought forward and all the wealth wouldn't be funneled off into just some little select corner of the City of London and Wall Street and its adjuncts, the financial centres in other countries as well. So that has been, as we said in the title, by design, and the Bank for International Settlements is a big part of it, and we're going to look at that, focus in on that a bit today.
Yeah, and you know, people will have only vaguely heard of the BIS, or Bank for International Settlements. It is a very powerful organisation, and it's based in Switzerland, as we'll come on to shortly. There's some interesting history there, which we want to underscore. But it is just worth understanding what they say about themselves. So this is actually their overall mission: to support central bankers' pursuit of monetary and financial stability through international cooperation, and to act as a bank for central banks, a banker, the bankers' bankers, as that's sometimes called, a forum for dialogue, a platform for responsible innovation and knowledge sharing, in-depth analysis and insights on core policy issues, and sound and competitive financial services. And I suppose at one level, you could say, well, that doesn't sound particularly worrisome, but...
No.
And there's a really big but. Behind it, there are a series of assumptions that people in this organization make about the way the world works, right? Which is, of course, neoliberalism, free market or market intervention, you know, along certain lines. And of course, we've seen recently how central banks have actually been pressing on inflation by lifting interest rates, pretty much willy-nilly, and not necessarily, you know, having good outcomes in terms of ordinary people. And, you know, Michelle Bullitt's quite recently said, oh, we have to do this because we have to clamp down on inflation. Now, it is interesting to note, because I don't know whether people understand this, the quantum of people who work at the BIS. So this is actually a recent piece of information which I found. The BIS is owned by 63 central banks, so not all central banks around the world. has a mandate to support global monetary and financial stability. It's the world's oldest international financial institution. It's headquartered in Basel, or Bâle, depending on which side of the fence you're on, since 1930. And it currently has, wait for it, about 700 staff. And they're also massively investing in a major redevelopment to build more facilities next to the tower that exists today already. And it is fascinating to me that this organization is rich beyond, you know, dreams of many people, is investing in way lots of new buildings, and it's got 700 people in it.
Oh, wow. Well, for people who haven't, you can read this book, The Tower of Basel. It's a very good and accessible, easy to read. There's a lot of histories that are a bit more complicated, but it talks about the BIS headquarters in Switzerland. And we can talk a bit more about why Switzerland later. But just to summarize, Labor goes through in that book how all the governors are assured the highest level of total confidentiality, the highest level of security. The Swiss authorities have no jurisdiction over the BIS premises. They enjoy similar protections to diplomatic embassies and the headquarters of the United Nations. They have the right to communicate in code and not have it intercepted, and receive correspondence in diplomatic bags covered by the same protection as embassies. It can't be opened by anyone outside, even, you know, for checking through customs or things like that. Everyone at the BIS and the BIS itself is exempt from Swiss taxes. So the employees don't even have to pay income tax. Senior managers enjoy a special status similar themselves to diplomats. Their bags can't even be searched at the airport or anything. Their papers are inviolable. The central bank governors, while they are in Basel and they go there, I think it used to be once a month at some points, but while they're in Switzerland, they have immunity under Swiss law. And all bank officials working there have immunity under Swiss law for life for all the acts carried out during the discharge of their duties. And like the BIS headquarters itself, they made it in such way that they never even have to, for instance, call the police. So it has high-tech sprinkler systems with multiple backup systems, in-house medical facilities, its own bomb shelter. Its assets can never be seized. It cannot be subject to civil claims. Everything is top secret. You know, no minutes are taken of any meeting. There's this tradition of privileged confidentiality that exists. And of course, most of the people that go there are public servants. They're paid by the public purse, and yet they enjoy, I mean, I'm talking about our central bank governors and people like that that we send over there. And of course, many of ours, like Philip Lowe, I think spent a couple of years in one stretch working there at one point. So it's a pretty wild setup.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, it sounds like it's a completely uncontrolled institution insofar with its own rules. You know, it's got essentially international travel facilities and protections as diplomats have. But where's the accountability? So the question I keep coming back to is, hang on a minute, how do you get the gig there, right? And of course, the point is here that, as you mentioned, a lot of the central bank operatives with inside individual countries are very strongly connected to the BIS. They spend a lot of time over there. They obviously think very similarly. And some people like Phil Lowe actually worked at the BIS. So there is a real big question here about accountability and about democracy, because, of course, nobody elects these people. And if you think about what they are doing, they are actually imposing top-down a series of philosophies the way the banks work. I'll give you an example. We have at the moment a booming mortgage market around the world. One of the reasons we have a booming mortgage market around the world, which of course has powered house prices, is because of the capital rules, which dictates how much capital individual banks have to hold against different assets. And funnily enough, the BIS rules basically shrank the amount of capital that is required to be held against mortgages, because, of course, mortgages are less risky, which means that banks then focused in massively on lending to households by way of mortgages for property. And what this has done is completely distorted property prices and the banking system. So in Australia, you know, our banks are predominantly big building societies. But it's all based on the rules that the BIS imposed, set, and then filtered down to the individual countries. So in Australia, of course, we have APRA. And so you could actually argue that in many ways, APRA is as connected to the BIS as it is to anything that it does locally. And there's
probably more so, I'd argue.
I was going to say, and there's been a couple of interesting examples where the BIS and the United Nations have both said, actually, APRA, you should be doing a little bit more on things like bail-in and those sorts of things. Don't worry about what the local government in Australia says. Follow us.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I was going to say that one of the things that we can thank the BIS for is adopting bail-in as the next great way to bail out our banks instead of public bailouts. You steal from the public purse, meaning the deposits or certain investments and certain bonds, bail-inable bonds, to re-liquefy, if that's a word, the bank, to keep it running, because at all costs you need to be able in a financial crisis to keep a bank running, because if it shuts down you're going to get contagion and it's going to spread. So, you know, make the people pay, the depositors and so forth. And of course it's been used numerous times in Europe from 2013 when it was first deployed in Cyprus. And the Bank for International Settlements has created a whole regime around bail-in, which it scripts and writes all the rules, and it dictates to governments, because our central banks have joined as members, and our central banks, even though some of them, like the Australian one, is a government-owned entity, they have independence, basically enshrined as gospel. And so because they're independent, they can do as they wish. They join up to the BIS. They therefore have to follow the script that's given to them, and also other regulatory agencies like APRA, because in Australia, APRA is the agency that administers our bail-in law. So they're beholden to follow that set of rules that these people who were never elected and can't be voted out have drafted up in their clubhouse in Basel. In their cushy restaurant up the top of that tower.
You can't make this stuff up, right? Because if you did, people wouldn't believe it was true. So let's just be clear. The rules of banking have been basically cooked up over a few generations, and we'll get into a bit more history shortly, right? By bankers who are interested, of course, in their own interests predominantly. And even today, they have huge amounts of power that effectively are going outside the normal rules of democracy, that have no accountability. You know, in Australia, for example, there's nothing we can do about. Now, obviously, APRA says, well, we can interpret the Bank of International Settlement rules, and they do a little bit around the margins. And of course, in the US at the moment, there's a big argument because the BIS want to make some changes to the way that the capital ratios go. And in fact, the banks in the US are pushing back against that. And there's now another review going on in the Federal Reserve. And I thought this was a really good week to discuss this because, of course, the Federal Reserve is having a love-in at the moment in the US. It's annual love fest, as it were. all the central bankers are there, all talking around this stuff. And you've got to ask the question, what's really going on here? And I think to understand that, we need to go back in history. So let's just revisit the foundational development of the BIS, how it bubbled up to the surface, how it grabbed so much power and control. And then we might come back to what's happening today and what this really says to us in terms of some of the questions that should be being asked.
Yes, for sure. And of course, the rise of the BIS, you have to go much earlier than it was created in 1930, but you have to go back much earlier to see where it came from and its rise intersects what we discussed last time with the doctrine of austerity coming to the fore. The British imperial system had utilized similar mechanisms as the BIS, but they did it directly because they were an empire. So you can look at the history of India with the British East India Company in the 1700s. You can look at the mid 1800s onwards to the turn of the century, debt commissions that Britain ran in across Africa, the Middle East, in the Balkans. But in the from the 1850s through the 1890s, there were a series of international monetary conferences held in Paris and Brussels. And basically there was an effort from that time to coordinate international finance top down, so countries would agree to go with things ranging from a single gold standard to an international currency, to an international clearinghouse. And that then escalated in the early 1900s, where you had the Italian Treasury Ministry Minister Luigi Luzzatti, who was pushing for an international financial commission or a central bank free from political interference. And when you read all the histories, you see this phrase over and over again, free from political interference. It's such a bad thing. They didn't really get a breakthrough in it, though, until the 1914 financial crisis. Things started to move and this push expanded. But you had, of course, the interruption of the war at that point. And so it picked up after World War One, in the period when the austerity doctrine was built. And so I want to start from that point and just read two quotes, one from an American historian and one from our own Jack Lang, an Australian Member of Parliament from the 1930s. So starting with Carol Quigley, this is a quote from Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, and it's an excellent summary of the intention behind the creation of the Bank for International Settlements. He said, "The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. Each central bank, in the hands of men like Montagu Norman of the Bank of England, Benjamin Strong of the New York Federal Reserve, Charles Rist of the Bank of France, and Hjalmar Schacht of the Reichsbank, sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world." Oh, we've never seen any of that in Australia, have we?
It's an amazing, amazing summary. And it really does drive to the heart, doesn't it, of what they were about. You know, these very powerful bankers protecting their own edifices, building a sandcastle based on their particular philosophy and independent of political influence.
That's right. Now, Jack Lang, this is a quote from The Great Bust, written in 1962. So this was his reflection on the earlier period. And he started off noting that World War I had given rise to national banks, as I mentioned before, and national credit in opposition to private financier-controlled central banks. And, of course, they were very worried this would continue and, in fact, take off in the post-war period when nations were very keen to rebuild their war-torn countries. So he said that the City of London needed to find ways and means of re-establishing the financial supremacy that had been lost during the war. Therefore, he said, some formula had to be devised which would enable such local institutions as the Commonwealth Bank of Australia to be drawn into the City of London's net. The financial experts studied the problem deeply. Out of their deliberations emerged the plan to centralise the control of all banking throughout the empire by channelling it directly into the supervision of the Bank of England. The Bank of England was to become the super banker's bank. The Commonwealth Bank of Australia was to be responsible for the local administration of Bank of England policy. It was to be the junior banker's bank. It was even decided to aim at a World Bank to be run by the League of Nations, which would direct the credit of the world and determine the economic policy of the world. The bankers were to be the supreme rulers. Naturally, the governor of the Bank of England expected to be at the apex of the system. With such control over banking, there should be no impediment in the way of controlling the government of the country as well. So, I mean, he doesn't use the Bank for International Settlements, but that is effectively what he was talking about. And, yeah, this control of the purse strings is always, you know, because it doesn't matter what area of government you want to talk about, nothing happens without money. So if you've got that control, you can control, as he put it, the government of the country as well. So that puts us at the period after World War One, and the creation of the Bank for International Settlements started almost immediately. During the war, you had the Supreme War Council, which were the Allied countries that had taken control as a group, as a block of nations, of things like raw materials and shipping and resources, because they had to work together among countries for the war effort. And straight after the war, at the Versailles Conference, the Peace Conference of 1919, they decided to make a parallel body to the Supreme War Council, which was called the Supreme Economic Council. And to administer that, they founded the League of Nations. And the League of Nations' primary body, or one of the key bodies of it, was called the Economic and Financial Organization. And the people in that body mainly came out of the British Treasury. And as we talked a little bit about in the last program we did, they had run a pilot project in Britain itself, showing the world this is what you have to do with austerity. You have to cut the budget, you have to rein in the spending. And they then went and conducted two other experiments or trial runs of that. One was in Italy, as we talked about, and the other was in Austria. And Austria is quite crucial to this. Arthur Salter from the Bank of England was one of the key guys, and Otto Niemeyer, who ran that program. And they made it work to the extent that it allowed the other agenda of the Versailles Conference, which was German reparations payments, to work. So what they trialled in Austria was such vicious austerity that even though the German reparations hadn't been working, Arthur Salter was able to come in and say, look, use this method that we just used in Austria. It works. And he wrote a whole paper about it. And he was reveling in the fact that he made this work. And now we can make Germany pay the post-war reparations because they were the guilty party and so forth. And it was in the process of doing that, that the Bank of Internet, the germ of the Bank for International Settlements came to be. In the meantime, you also had had the Brussels and Genoa conferences of 1920 and 1922, which determined a new financial code of austerity. And then Montagu Norman intersected this, the head of the Bank of England, in 1921, when he wrote a central bank manifesto where he laid out in dot points exactly the job of central banks being responsible for overseeing economic policy, because they wanted to, as we were saying earlier, take economic policy out of the hands of elected officials. It's too important. And in 1925 was when, I think we talked about it before, Montagu Norman called for a private and eclectic central bankers club that would then coordinate and work together on this. And in, you've got the graphic here of the meeting that they had in mid-1927 in New York City, where you had Hjalmar Schacht. He, of course, was the head of the Reichsbank, but I'll say something more about him in a moment. But then you have Benjamin Strong from the US Fed, Montagu Norman, and Charles Rist, who was their French counterpart. And so they already were talking about the sorts of things that the Bank for International Settlements would become. But in earlier than that, in late 1923, Hjalmar Schacht, because the turmoil that was going on in Germany with reparations was incredible, and that's a whole nother story, of course. But he was brought in as the currency commissioner of the Reich, and was given near dictatorial powers. Of course, this was over 10 years before Hitler came in. He was already being given these extensive near dictatorial powers. I think it was his biographer that described it that way. 1 month later, after coming into that position, he was made president of the Reichsbank and went to London to meet Montague Norman. They became such good friends that Norman, I think it was the godfather to Schacht's grandchild, or maybe it was vice versa. So they were very tight. And in 1924, the reparations payments were reorganized according to the Austria pilot program that had been run. They were interrupted by 1929 because of the financial crash and the Great Depression beginning to hit. But then you had certain people. JP Morgan had been one of the key figures. In fact, Thomas Lamont, who worked for JP Morgan, had been the guy at Versailles who worked out the amount of money Germany had to repay, because it wasn't exactly an easy thing to figure out. But they started agitating around 1930 for the necessity to reorganize reparations again, because Germany had no chance of ever paying it. It was almost a write-off. So that was reorganized under what became known as the Young Plan. Owen Young was another agent of JP Morgan. And at that time, they figured out how to commercialize reparations repayments so that, as Quigley puts it, it was like rain coming down from heaven, all the commissions they were getting from, even though Germany had paid more than what it originally even said was said to have owed and still was owing more, it was just mounting. So these bankers demanded, we need a central bank, a independent agency that would be able to administer these reparations payments to make it work. And that was essentially the beginning. And when the Young Plan was initiated, it included this plan to establish the Bank for International Settlements. And then when the bank was established by international treaty among governments, with the central banks being the members. Schacht was on the board. I mean, it's commonly said that Hjalmar Schacht and Montague Norman created the bank, but people throughout the austerity paper that I mentioned and that we talked about last week were involved in it. So you had, for example, an advisor to Mussolini was on the BIS organization committee to establish the bank. He was also close to Montague Norman. You had a guy from the League of Nations Financial and Economic Committee that I mentioned before, who had worked on the Austria austerity project. And you had people from the Bank of England, like Sir Basil Blackett and JP Morgan and Owen Young, who were part of the expert committee that was advising the setup of the bank. So that's the short version of how it was created. And of course, then their actual history begins from that point.
It's an amazing story. And the whole point about this is you need to understand, of course, the historic context. But the power of those bankers and their ability to be able to step round politics and round accountability to envision what they thought the future was is the cornerstone of it, right? Now, we can't leave democracy to run this. We need to actually dictate a particular way of working. Now, that dictation had a particular set of assumptions about the way that finances worked, the need for austerity, all those things that we've touched on previously. And when you actually stand back and think about what was created at that point, an independent organization, independent of government, dictatorial in its approach, with a particular set of doctrines, that's essentially what we've still got today, isn't it?
It is. And, one of the hallmarks of that, which the BIS is infamous for, they were so independent that they allowed the requests of the Nazis to transfer gold from the coffers of the nations that they conquered, starting with the gold held by the Czech Central Bank in the Bank of England. And the Bank for International Settlements said, you know, we can't interfere in this. This is a technocratic decision. We have to allow it to go ahead. The Bank of England allowed it to go ahead because Montagu Norman said, I can't imagine any step more improper than to bring governments into the current banking affairs of the BIS. And Otto Niemeyer weighed in on it. He said that there was no legal reason why the instructions should not be executed and the transaction was therefore carried out in the usual manner. So all throughout the war, the Bank for International Settlements was assisting the Nazis to get the gold they needed to continue the war effort. And furthermore, the bank is said to have acted as an intelligence interface between business and industrial circles in the US that were supporting and working with industrialists inside Germany to allow it to go ahead. Alan Dulles, who was the head of American intelligence based also in Bern in Switzerland, worked very closely with people inside the Bank for International Settlements, and a lot of information and intelligence changed hands through these networks that allowed the Nazis to get as far as what they did. And over a dozen key Nazis held positions at the Bank for International Settlements before and during the war. So it's an evil nest, and there was an effort to get rid of it after the war, which the British actually shot down at the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944. John Maynard Keynes was actually the representative for the British, and they basically threatened to leave the conference if this went ahead. So the clause that had called for the Bank for International Settlements to be shut down, because there was a big scandal about what it had done with this gold and other things during the war, but it was watered down because of the British threatening to leave, and then that would have upset the apple cart with the creation of the IMF and World Bank and the institutions that created those Bretton Woods institutions thereafter. So they decided they'd better water it down, and basically it was just, oh, we will look at closing the BIS at the earliest practicable moment or something to that effect. And it just sat there, and because Roosevelt died and his finance minister, Henry Morgenthau, was ousted after about 3 months, so there was no one there pushing and fighting for it. And basically the BIS was happy to bide its time until it gradually re-emerged after people had begun to forget about this and rise again, because it carved out a little niche for itself with things like the statistics it would put out, compiling data, and it sort of made itself indispensable over time in that way.
Yes, and of course it does have some accountabilities to do with the international transference of funds and all of those things. And, you know, yeah, that's what they play up, and they play up the rules of the road that they've developed and all of those things. But I want to underscore again, it's within a particular philosophical substract that actually says, do this, don't do that. You know, lend here, don't lend there. Mm. And that's a real problem in my mind, because I would argue that they've completely distorted the financial system and allowed the financial system to be distorted with the rise of derivatives and some of those other things, and have been very, very weak on some of the things that they should have been much more acutely aware of, because we've got massive derivatives exposures around the world at the moment. And with financial volatility, of course, it becomes more an issue. But I just want to come back to another point, because there was a really interesting quote from 1930. And this is actually Sir Otto Niemeyer in Australia in 1930, Bank of England Governor Montagu Norman was ordered him to, quote, distrust all Australian governments and ministers. Mm. And I think this highlights once again very nicely the contention between the world of politics and, you know, the democratically elected and the other, the stuff that's not actually democratically controlled. And even today, you know, that you watch some of the interplay in the Senate and the House Economic Committee, you got to say that the questions that are bowled by the politicians at the governor of, for example, the Reserve Bank in Australia, or indeed other central banks in other places, they're all very, very, you know, kid glove. We don't ask too many hard questions. So there is still this sort of sense, oh, we can't touch that. That's too powerful, and it's sort of, you know, too highly charged. And so the politicians veer away rather than veer towards.
Yeah, and that is where another factor comes in, because after World War II, this faction that controlled the Bank for International Settlements had a slight problem in that, again, countries had begun to utilise national credit and so forth. And you had Franklin Roosevelt after the war, you know, transforming the US with development. You had in Britain, Clement Attlee, who did the same thing. And so a lot of the people in these circles, in these banking networks, feared that liberalism was over, that it was dead, and they said that openly. And so this was where another key moment in the creation of neoliberalism came about, when the Mont Pelerin Society was created, again in Switzerland. And this was Mont Pelerin is a mountain in Switzerland, it was created by all of the same people, all of the same networks. Ludwig von Mises, who people would have heard of, and that's Friedrich von Hayek, left. Von Hayek was the protege of von Mises, and this was their first meeting in 1947. But these two guys, von Mises and Hayek, they were the advisors of the Austrian Chancellor, Ignaz Seipel, who was running Austria when Otto Niemeyer and Arthur Salter and the League of Nations economic and financial outfit went in there and ran this austerity project and slashed all the government departments and cut the budgets. And as I said, that was the model for German reparations. This is how we can take more money out of their hides to keep our financial system going. So those two, after the war, Hayek actually moved to Britain, and he in 1931 started up, had a chair at the London School of Economics, which wouldn't surprise anybody. And in 1938, they started to collaborate. There was a meeting in Paris to plot the future of liberalism. This is when they're all saying, oh, is liberalism over and so forth. And there were various other meetings, in fact, February 1944, at King's College at Cambridge University. Hayek and a collaborator of Montague Norman at the Bank of England, John Clapham, held a conference of the political society, and they decided, yes, we have to create a new institution that would basically bring politicians under our spell, you know, which is what you were basically saying. The politicians don't challenge this stuff because they've been indoctrinated. And then in October 1945 was the first meeting, which took place at Zurich in Switzerland. And this was organised by a senior official of Credit Suisse, a guy called Albert Hunold. He had met von Hayek and invited him to come and address the university. These two had met, and this is another intersection point, at something called the Graduate Institute, which was a League of Nations think tank, I guess, before they'd heard of think tanks. And that was basically one of these institutions that attracted a lot of the thinkers at that time that were involved in this austerity project. So they already knew each other from that point. And they brought together at this October 1945 Zurich conference a whole bunch of Swiss industrialists and bankers. And von Hayek at that point proposed, we need to have a week-long meeting at a Swiss hotel in the mountains to discuss, this is a quote, to discuss the foundation of a new liberalism in the Western world. So that was their plan. Now, Hunold had an outfit called the Swiss Institute of International Studies, which he'd started a couple of years earlier. And that then became a feeder outfit to create and establish and furnish the Mont Pelerin Society. So to corral the funding, to get the logistics together. But it was British financiers from the City of London, including a guy called Sir Alfred Sewenson Taylor, who was a City of London financier, and a guy called Harley Drayton, who was a media mogul and a top financier, the head of Midland Bank. He chaired 20 trusts, investment trusts, and 23 companies, including he managed the funds for the Church of England and the British Crown. And he ran the first newspaper of the City of London called City Press. And he corralled, he basically tapped the Swiss networks that would put funding in, the Bank of England and other networks that put money in, particularly for the first conference of the Mont Pelerin Society to take place, which was 36 or 39 individuals that came. And again, it included people that had worked on all these various projects, including one of Mussolini's advisors who ran the austerity come fascism program there. And that's when they started having regular summits and coming up with a whole set of neoliberal tenets that were non-negotiable and which we live with and with the effects of today.
Yes, it's astonishing to think that those foundations which were laid so many years ago are still haunting us today. And I find this cartoon quite interesting. This is actually a Labour movement cartoon from the 1930s, where Sir Otto Nyman of the Bank of England advises lowering Australia's unjustified high standard of living, right? Mm. It is scary to think that there is actually an intent, a deliberate intent through this neoliberal or the liberal philosophy to effectively impose austerity on the broader population to support the financial system and the financial elite, you know, the old money power story. And the seeds are laid right back here in this conversation that we've just had, and yet it's still to the fore today. And most politicians have no idea, no idea at all, that this is actually the fundamental philosophical substrate that's actually driving a lot of the way that a lot of people think, the way that the financial system works, the way that central banks work. And very importantly, and I want to underscore this, these are non-democratic entities like the BIS and World Economic Forum, right? They've sort of bubbled up to the top because of the fact that they've got the power. And yet there's no accountability. And I don't understand how in a democratic context this can make any sense at all.
Well, that's it. And the thing is, though, that we can take their power away. I mean, we have elected parliaments that can say tomorrow, we're not going to take any notice of what the BIS has to say. And indeed, we could, you know, and it's happened in Britain, renationalise the central bank. I mean, our plans, the Citizens Party plans to have a people's bank, to turn the Commonwealth Bank into what it used to be, could involve that idea, because this notion of independent central banks, we've just showed we've had it for a while, doesn't seem to have worked very well, apart for a select few, of course. But yeah, it does involve, as you said, a lot of politicians, a lot of people don't realise that they're in the grips of this madness, because their brain is populated with these ideas and they never have considered anything different. It's like the famous quote of John Maynard Keynes, where he said, you know, most politicians are the slaves of some defunct economist. Well, these are the defunct economists that we're talking about. And to them, it's very deliberate to set all this in place. In fact, the Mont Pelerin Society said, you know, our members shouldn't go out and run for parliament. We want them to be the academics, in the media, in the think tanks. We want them to be the ones funneling the ideas to the politicians. And they set up institutions in across the globe in hundreds of countries. There's 100 neoliberal think tanks at the very least, and the MPS has some 500 members and over 250 affiliated organisations, and these range from the Australian ones, such as the Centre for Independent Studies, the Institute of Public Affairs, the H.R. Nicholls Society and the Tasman Institute, to the big British one, the Institute of Economic Affairs, the Adam Smith Institute, and American outfits like the Cato Institute, the Hoover Institution, the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, that are affiliated. And of course, it's not only on the economic front that they push this ideology, but on the war front, unfortunately, as well. Neoconservative kind of policy direction, war hawk ideas.
And that's really the point, right? Because the fundamental philosophical ideas that underpin the way that they think are leading us into a very dark place. But it doesn't have to be like that. Because obviously, if we can really understand how things work, and then we can begin to sort of move in a different direction. And, you know, the public bank is part of that. But I guess as Jackson Hole is running at the moment, you know, the central bankers loving that I mentioned earlier on, it's worth just remembering when you see all this reporting of what these central bankers are saying, and again, the press are very deferential to a lot of these players, just remember that they come from a very worrisome foundation. The Bank for International Settlements is essentially a non-regulated, a non-accountable organization that has huge amounts of power. In the US, of course, the central banks there are owned by the banks themselves. In Australia, it's a bit different. So there are different structures. But all of the major economies in the West are very much connected to the BIS. Of course, there are other central banks in other places around the world that don't necessarily follow the same way of thinking, and that's an interesting observation. Of course, we don't hear much about that because we're always given the particular set of spin that we're talking about at the moment. But in terms of actually laying the foundations for a better future, we've got to really ask some hard questions about these technocrats, the people who think they know all the answers, who have a particular way of thinking. And I do want to put up again the United Nations, the World Economic Forum, and the BIS. They're part of the same problem. I mean, if you watch some of them in play, for example, at Davos, where you have the financial and business elite meeting with all of these players, that they've got these views as to how the world should be. And of course, it's things like a central bank digital currency, and it's sort of the centralization of the control of finances and the dictation and top-down imposition of policies into particular countries and to particular governments and systems. But again, it's not actually through an elected process. It's simply through a position of money and a position of power. And that tells you all you need to know about what's wrong and what needs to change.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. And we can change it. I mean, one of the reasons, I was just going to add that one of the reasons why a lot of these outfits are based in Switzerland is because they've always had this neutral status, but and they, from the 1900s and I think 1924, they had secrecy laws, but they strengthened them in 1932 when French politicians tried to crack down on tax evaders that were going and setting up their Swiss bank accounts. And, of course, the Swiss refused to cooperate them in any way. And when the French imprisoned two bank officials from a Swiss bank, for refusing to cooperate with their investigation, the Swiss bank, a number of actual bankers drew up a new secrecy law. Until then, the secrecy was only protected by civil and commercial codes, but this new law meant that breaching secrecy would be a criminal offence punishable by law. And this was like this duty of absolute silence that was then adopted. That's why they're kind of housed there. But as I said earlier, you know, we don't have to be slaves to that. And in Australia, we haven't got it yet. We haven't got that kind of law, although a lot of the political fights we're taking on are you know, verging in that direction, such as the fight to stop Jim Chalmers taking the clause out of our banking reserve banks legislation, governing legislation that says that the bank has to ultimately be accountable to the government. So they're trying to move in that direction, but we still have a democracy. The people still have a voice, and we still have the capability to wind back the clock on some of these things that should never have happened, and indeed to forge into the future with much better policy ideas and directions.
Yeah, and I think the key point here is that we need to make sure that our politicians really understand some of these issues. Many of them have no idea, and frankly, they're over-influenced by the Treasury, which of course is completely wired into this same way of thinking. So it's really important that we help some of our politicians wake up to some of the things. There are alternatives. There are different strategies that could be adopted. And there is some capacity always to zig when everybody else zags, right? So we don't necessarily have to blindly follow. And I think central bank digital currency is one of those, right? That there is, Michelle Bullock said the other day, giving evidence in front of the House Economic Committee, that there's further work going on central bank digital currency. There'll be a paper coming out in September, et cetera. The whole notion that this should somehow be imposed on the economy is in the same class as removing cash. And I remember some time ago, Michelle Bullock suggested that maybe we should be charged for using cash. Well, that went well, didn't it?
Yeah.
And so that, you know, these are important decisions. And I always want to underscore, being a philosopher myself, I want to understand the assumptions that people are actually driven by. And for me, this is a really important point, that a lot of the policies that we are seeing are being driven by bad assumptions about the way the world works. And those assumptions benefit a few, but unfortunately the many are picking up the tab. And we're seeing that at the moment with the way that inflation is being, quote, busted. But unfortunately people are being busted along the way. And I know it's sometimes, Lisa, a bit frustrating insofar that people say, no, I can't do anything. You know, I'm an individual. What can I do against this point? But the point is, you are one individual among many individuals, right? If you get enough people who actually start asking the right questions, you can make change. And we did that through the cash ban, and we've done it through other things too. So it's really important that we actually use this not just as a sort of an excuse to hide under the duvet, as it were, but actually grasp some of these issues. And, you know, the future is malleable. So this is an important conversation, not just for the past, but also for what could be happening in the future too.
I mean, it's immensely powerful for individuals to talk to their politicians, write to them, ring them up, even talk to their aides and advisors who have a big impact on them. And even if you don't convince them, as you said before, they have, their minds are filled with axioms and assumptions that they've never really questioned. They've just thought, this is the way it's done. So even by you planting questions in their mind, it might not seem to have an immediate impact, but it'll sit there like a burr under the saddle until at a certain point, as the crisis gets worse, they're going to be like, oh, what's happening here? I need to shift something. I need to change something. And a thought will pop into their head that came perhaps from you or somewhere. So, you know, if they get pummeled enough with this at every turn, eventually it will begin to have an impact as reality hits, because the point is that all these policies they've followed, as we can see quite clearly, have failed.
Well, they've failed for ordinary people, but they have made the few percent massively richer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look around the world, you can see a small number of people with massive amounts of power, not really very controlled power, massive amounts of wealth, but ordinary people are the ones being thrown under the bus. And it doesn't have to be like that. There are alternatives. So I've very much enjoyed the conversation with you today. Thank you very much for sharing your research. And just to say that this is some extracts from some amazing publications that you've made available. We'll put the links below. It's really important, I think, for people to understand the past, but not just academic interest, because it can inform the future as well. And the more that we can take and own the future, the more likely is we can shape the future to a better outcome for the majority of people, which of course is should be what it's about. Thank you very much for your time and for your research. And I'm sure we'll be chatting again, because there are many other aspects to austerity that we could also touch on, I suspect.
Oh, it could go on forever. Yeah, no, you're welcome. Thanks very much, Martin. Terrific. Thanks to the viewers watching, and yeah, stay tuned.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We'll see you again. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Cheerio.